the opportunity to stick here. The title is on natural gravity, and can I have the next slide? Okay. So this slide gives some motivations for this work. Main motivation was to try to understand how non-inimitability of perturbative quantum gravity manifests itself in the polynomial formulations of GR that we know, love, and use as starting point for non-perturbative quantization in, say, loop quantum gravity or spin form model. And the hope was that something new can be learned about quantum geometry at Planck scales as a result of this work. The next slide, please. The polynomial formulation that I will use is that due to Klebanski. Here is the reference. This formulation is rather well known in our community. We often like to refer to it as the BF formulation of gravity. And on the next slide, number 4, I give some main results of what I'm going to talk about today and some main messages. So the first thing is that a very simple dimensional analysis shows that the action, Klebanski action one starts with, is incomplete in the sense that certain other terms compatible with the symmetries of the same mass dimension can be added to the action and therefore must be added because they will be needed to observe the rising UV divergences. And so these terms are usually called counterterms in quantum field theory. There is an infinite number of such counterterms. And in that respect, this formulation is no better than usual perturbative, than usual metric-based quantum gravity. So there is an infinite number of counterterms arising. However, some simplifications do occur in this formulation. The first one of these is that the freedom of field redefinition that we have in this formulation is larger, I'll explain in what sense, than in the usual metric-based formulation. And the second, and that's less trivial, is that it turns out that no counterterms containing derivatives of the Lagrange multiplier field, psi, ever appear. So taking all this into account, one finds that all the possible counterterms can be combined into a single scalar function of two variables. And, well, this is equation one. Because of this, the behavior of gravity under renormalization in this formulation is more transparent than in the usual metric-based one. Because renormalization group flow acting on the Lagrangian is just a flow acting on the space of this function, phi. This makes a complete understanding of the flow within reach. And for example, this can be used for testing of some standing conjectures about quantum GR, for example, asymptotic safety conjecture of Weinberg. In this formulation, this conjecture takes the form that as one sends energy off to infinity, the renormalization group flow, which is a flow on this function phi, just stops, terminates at a fixed point, which just corresponds to a particular function phi of two variables. So that's my outline of the quantum part of the talk. And on the next slide, there are some messages about what kind of quantum gravity theory one gets. So remember that in usual metric-based formulation, quantum corrected theory is a modified gravity theory because, well, quantum corrections modify Einstein-Hilbert action by adding to it higher order terms in the curvature. Something similar happens here. However, unlike the metric-based formulation, the theory one gets, the quantum corrected theory one gets, is second-order derivatives only, which makes its study much simpler. So it's second derivatives. The second very important fact is that metric emerges from this theory only after conformal factor. I'll explain that much more in detail, but those of you who remember BF formulation of GR, remember that metric arises in this formulation as a on-shell the consequences of one of the equations of motion. So when one varies with respect to Lagrange multiplier field, one gets what can be called metricity equations. Very similar thing happens in this modified gravity theory, quantum corrected theory. However, equations only imply that a metric exists up to a conformal factor. And for this reason, I thought it was natural to refer to this theory as non-metric gravity. The modifications, as in metric-based formulation, modifications due to quantum corrections become important for large curvatures. And at the end of the talk, I'm going to explore what these modifications mean for quantum geometry. I'm going to just analyze simplest possible scenario, spherically symmetric solution, and we'll see that space-time singularity is avoided inside the black hole due to these quantum corrections. So that's the outline. The next slide, please. Are there any questions at this point? No. Okay. Let me continue then. Let me start by reminding you about these polynomial formulations of GR, and I'll build up to Klebanski formulation. But this first slide is a reminder about the usual metric-based formulation, and this is the one due to Einstein. Here is Einstein-Hilbert action. When one does quantum theory, one decomposes the metric into a background, which is usually taken to be flat, plus a fluctuation. And so it's subject, it's part of the field subject to fluctuations. To give the kinetic term that arises here, namely the term quadratic in this fluctuating part, the usual form, the form that we usually have in quantum field theory, namely derivative of this field squared, one has to make this fluctuating part of the metric dimension full. One has to give it dimension, mass dimension 1. Well, we're in four dimensions, so this is why it's mass dimension 1. And for this, one has to absorb square root of g newton into this fluctuating part of the metric, because metric is usually kept dimensionless. And it's easy to trace after that how square root of g newton becomes a coupling constant of the theory, because once it's absorbed into the quadratic term, it shows up in front of the cubic term, and so it does become coupling constant of this theory. Because it has negative mass dimension minus 1, simple power counting arguments show that this theory is non-renormalizable. Namely, counter terms needed to absorb the divergences will proliferate, there will be an infinite number of them. All possible powers of the curvature and, well, all possible invariants constructed from the curvature will arise as counter terms. So it's non-renormalizable. What it means for us is, actually, it doesn't mean the statement that quantum gravity is non-renormalizable does not mean that it doesn't make sense. Actually, just that statement, it makes a physical prediction. Namely, it makes a prediction that some new physical effects should appear at Planckian energies. Practically, what it means is that theory, when we try to do a calculation close to Planck energies, there is ambiguity in that calculation. There is no way to make that such a calculation can give us any prediction. So, phrase it differently, we don't understand what UV completion of this theory is. But for low energies, perturbative quantum gravity is perfectly fine. So, just rephrasing, problem of non-renormalizability is problem of understanding what UV completion of the theory is, what's the behavior of the theory at very large energies. Next slide, please. Here's some reminder about first order formulation of gravity in its Einstein-Hartmann form, theory of gravity becomes theory of tetras or frame field or Fierbein. And here, the Fierbein is denoted by theta I. I is internal index, runs from 0 to 3. And, well, tetras, Fierbeins are one forms, so I use form notations. Next slide, please. I'm running through it very quickly because I hope our community knows this formulation very well. Just a brief remark about Newton constants. Remember that in metric-based formulation, it was important to understand where Newton constant sits because it was responsible for non-renormalizability. It's interesting to note that Newton constant can be absorbed into the fields in this formulation by simple, very simple rescaling. So if the frame field is given mass dimension 1 and also 1 changes the cosmological constant, then Newton constant is absorbed into the field and never appears in the action. Something similar will happen in Lebansky formulation. Next slide, please. One could try to use this first order formulation as a starting point for quantization. However, there is no, and indeed in 3D, this is what one typically does, and in 3D, very well, that quantum gravity is proved to be renormalizable, even super renormalizable, exactly in this formulation. One expands around zero metric, around zero background, and the theory is extremely simple. However, in 4D and in higher dimensions, this doesn't work for a very simple reason that there is no term quadratic in the fields in the first order action. The first term, the lowest order term, is cubic in the fields. So we can't really use usual perturbative techniques because, well, we need some kinetic term, something quadratic in the fields to start off perturbation theory. And so on the next slide, number 10, there is Lebansky formulation. Now there is a kinetic form. There is a kinetic term in the action. The idea of this formulation is, in the first order formulation, metric was separated from the connection. In Lebansky formulation, one further separates curvature from the metric and the connection. So one has three independent fields. However, metric becomes hidden in a certain other quantity, which is a two-form, valued in some Lie algebra, and I'll refer to this two-form as B. So we have B, A, and the curvature field, psi, which I'll also refer to as Lagrange multiplier field. Action is given by equation 5. I hope it's familiar. The first term is BF. And we have the cosmological term, and then there's a term psi bd, where psi is Lagrange multiplier field. So one often refers to this formulation as BF formulation, so because action is BF plus a constraint. Indeed, the last term, psi bb, has a form of constraint, because when one varies with respect to psi, one gets a certain equation which doesn't involve psi, and which has the form of constraint that has to be imposed on B. This constraint guarantees, and this is on the next slide, slide number 11, if you look at the first of these equations, this is exactly that constraint that I'm talking about. This constraint implies that B is a self-dual part of the two-form that is structured from a metric. So it guarantees that certain metric can be introduced. And then equation 6 relates that metric to the connection. It says that connection is a self-dual part of connection compatible with the metric. And then the middle equation says that psi is the wild part of the curvature, of the Riemann curvature of the metric. And that's the content of the theory, content of field equations. And this is why this theory is equivalent to Einstein's GR. Next slide, please. Again, very simply scaling, absorbing Newton constant into the fields makes Newton constant disappear. There is now kinetic term for all the fields except for psi. And actually this is why, well, this problem that there is no kinetic term for psi was realized immediately as 3D gravity was tried and done. People try to do something similar in four dimensions. People try to use BF formulation, but the problem was always that there is no kinetic term for psi. So let me postpone this problem. I'll return to it later on. Let me not integrate over psi for now. Let me try to integrate over all other fields, but but keeping psi an external field. So this can be compared to what we can do in QED, for example. Equation 7 is QED Lagrangian without the usual kinetic term for the connection field, for the electromagnetic potential. So there is no F squared term here. This is just the fermionic part of the Lagrangian. One can quantize this theory, keeping A external field, keeping A fixed, and then one finds that first loop correction to this theory generates a certain term, generates a divergence, which has the form of F squared times an infinite coefficient, times a divergent coefficient. So quantum corrections do generate a kinetic term for the connection. And so the idea is to try to see if anything like this happens in Plibonsky theory. Any questions so far? Okay, the next slide. So,
Kirill, can you wait a second? I'm sorry, but there is a question from Utrecht here. Just a second.
Okay.
Hi, this is Artyom.
Okay.
Just a question. Why are you using Plibonsky action for this game? Because in Plibonsky action, you have a field with zero canonical dimension with which you can construct infinitely many counter terms.
Yes.
But you can still expand, represent gravity in terms of F plus something without introducing a field, any field of zero canonical dimension.
Yeah, I know about that one. I never tried McDowell. Actually, I believe Luan Fidel said that, but I don't really know that.
Yeah, there is such a way.
Yeah, but that's what I'm doing. Okay, next slide, 13. The first step in analyzing UV behavior of any theory is to try to produce at least the four possible divergent terms. And this is what we're going to do. So first we need to discuss mass dimensions of all the fields. Connection field has usual dimension, mass dimension 1, because, well, it appears it has the same dimension as the derivative operator. After absorbing into B 1 over G Newton, B receives mass dimension 2, or, well, length dimension minus 2, if you want. And then psi also gets rescaled. Psi used to be curvature, so it was dimension full. But after absorbing G Newton into it, it becomes dimensionless. So because we have a dimensionless field in the game, it's obvious that all powers of this dimensionless field will appear. And this is what is given on the next slide, number 14. It's clear that in addition to the term psi bb, all the terms of the type given in equation 9 will appear. So all possible combinations, all possible powers of the field itself, traces of its powers, all these terms will appear with undetermined coefficients. So from this perspective, it seems that this theory is as non-normalizable, as hard to analyze as usual perturbative metric-based quantum gravity. In the usual case, we have dimension-full Newton constant. This is what causes all those counter terms to appear. In our case, we have a field of mass dimension 0. Note that even the type of divergences, the type of counter terms is similar, because in the usual formulation, these are powers of the curvature. Here we have powers of this Lagrange multiply field. But on shell, this field used to be curvature, used to be wild curvature. So it's a similar divergence, even though psi used to be wild part of the curvature, and what one usually gets in metric-based formulation is Ricci, well, is full Riemann, but in particular Ricci part also appears. So there is some important similarities here, important differences here, sorry. On next slide, number 15, it's clear that these terms, powers of psi, will appear not only in front of BB term, but also in terms in front of BF term, and also FF type terms will be generated with all powers of psi in front of them. So that's the structure of the Lagrangian. And I'll indicate later on that this is not, even that is not the most general Lagrangian, not most general renormalized Lagrangian. Terms containing derivatives of psi can also appear, but I will say something about that later on. So let us now analyze this Lagrangian. So it seems that it's a pretty complicated thing. We have many nested infinities here. There is lots of possible infinite terms, infinite number of terms in front of any of these terms. So is it usual non-enumerability? Well, not quite, because we have field definition freedom. So on the next slide, slide number 16, we are free to redefine the field B. In usual quantum field theory, well, we do redefinitions all the time, but those are typically of multiplicative nature. Here we're free to do additive field redefinition. So we're free to add to B certain function of psi times the curvature. And it's clear that we can get rid of FF term. Then by rescaling of the B field, we can map BF term into its canonical form. And so it's clear that after this B field redefinitions, we can map the Lagrangian to its original form, BF plus something complicated times VB, and where this something complicated can even be calculated using those XYZ quantities introduced on the previous slide. But we will not need this formula 12. So formula 11 is what we need. And now on the next slide, 17, there is one more field definition that we can do. It's because what appears in front of VB, what appears is a complicated expansion in powers of psi. Importantly, this complicated thing is no longer traceless. I didn't mention it, but field psi in Plibonsky formulation is required to be traceless. And this is important because when one varies with respect to this traceless part, one gets exactly the metricity equations in Plibonsky theory. So this tracelessness condition satisfied by psi is important. And it's equivalent to one of Bianchi identities satisfied by Weyl curvature. So now we have a very similar action, but the field that sits in front of BD is not traceless anymore. However, we can decompose it into a trace part, which I call phi. So in this equation 13, we have delta AB phi of psi and a traceless part, which I call big phi. So it's clear that we can just redefine the Lagrange multiplier field and call field big field phi, which is traceless, to be the renormalized field psi. And then the trace part becomes a function of this renormalized traceless field. So the structure of the Lagrangian is given on the next slide, slide number 18. The effect of counter terms is in replacing the bare curvature field by a renormalized one, and we have an extra term, which is trace part, next extra term appearing in the Lagrangian. It is that term that I was referring to in my outline. It is that function phi. And let me explain, well, I think I explained that on the next slide, why is it a function of two variables only. Because being a scalar function, phi can only depend on eigenvalues, can only be a function of eigenvalues of psi. And because psi is traceless, we have two eigenvalues. So phi is a function of only two variables. Equivalently, it's a function of trace of psi squared and trace of psi cube. These are the only two invariants that can be constructed from traceless 3x3 matrix, which psi is. And so we get the conclusion that after all possible field redefinitions, the most general Lagrangian is determined by this function phi. So it's clear that renormalization group flow will be just the flow in the space of such functions. And I would like to return to the previous slide, slide 18, and mention that now a comment on this possibility that derivatives of psi appear. Actually, there are a few terms containing derivatives of psi that can be written down. However, a detailed analysis shows that those loop diagrams that can produce these terms containing derivatives of psi, they vanish. I don't know of any simple explanation for this fact, so I only know how to prove it using computing Feynman diagrams. But the claim is that to one loop order, which I analyzed, no derivatives of psi appear. And, well, it seems to me that this should persist to higher orders in loops, but I have not verified that. So the claim that this is the most general Lagrangian is to one loop order only. Okay, next slide, 19, and I explained what that slide is already. So let me go to next slide, slide number 20. Before I do that, are there any questions about quantum theory? Maybe I should summarize. I argued that the renormalization in this formulation becomes rather simple in the sense that all the contour terms can be combined into one new term, one term that has a form, certain function of two variables times BD. There is still infinite ambiguity in that contour term. Because any function, for example, can be determined by expanding it into Taylor series and its arguments, and we have infinite number of coefficients that we need to determine this function. There is still an infinite ambiguity, so in the usual sense, this theory is non-renormalizable. However, the flow, renormalization group flow, becomes rather simple and transparent.
There is a question from Penn State.
Yes.
Hi. The effective, the new action that you have, is it possible to recover the Einstein's equations,
yep,
for example, from there? Or what are the modifications that you
see? I'll explain that in this part of the talk when I talk about this non-metric modified gravity. I'll explain how to get back to usual metric-based formulation.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions? There is a question here. I'll just move the microphone.
Hello. On one of the previous slides, you had this function small phi that had a delta AB. Can I think of that term as modifying the cosmological constant? Is that a good way of thinking about it?
Okay. The question was if that term has anything to do with modified cosmological constant. Yeah, it's suggestive to think like that, because this term appears in the action exactly like the cosmological constant. However, it's not a constant anymore. It's a field. Well, in particular, it can depend from point to point in space-time. But yes, I would like to think of the nature of modification that appears here is that when curvature becomes large, when wild curvature, when this field psi becomes large, one gets some kind of effective cosmological constant that does something that modifies the theory. So yeah, that's kind of how modification works. Okay, so let me continue. So we get a modified gravity theory. Well, the fact that we got modified theory is not surprising, because this is exactly what happens in any formulation. Quantum character theory is modified theory. What will be surprising is that, what is surprising is that this theory is still second order. If you remember, in usual metric-based formulation, we have higher powers of curvature, and so even theory modified by curvature squared already have higher derivatives. And because of that has many, many difficulties. this theory is second order in derivatives, and this fact makes it extremely easy to analyze. The second surprise is that metricity equations get modified. If you remember, metricity equations followed from Plibonsky theory by varying the action with respect to Lagrange multiplier field, with respect to psi. So one can do the same here, but this is the equation. Equation 16 is what one gets. This no longer implies that the two-form field B is metric, comes from tetrad in the usual sense, in the sense that B is a wedge product of two tetrads. And we see that this non-metricity is unavoidable whenever there is non-zero curvature phi, when there is non-zero curvature psi, because then this extra term containing phi, will play a role. Next slide, please. However, detailed analysis of this equation shows that certain metric can still be introduced, but it can be introduced up to conformally scaling. There is no natural conformal factor appearing as a solution of this equation, but light cone structure, natural light cone structure, does appear as a consequence of that metricity equation. Equations of motion one gets then, as I said, they're second order in derivatives, and they relate this metric, which is only defined up to conformal factor, but choosing certain arbitrary conformal factor, one gets a metric. So equations relate derivatives of this metric, a metric itself, components of this Lagrange multiplier field, psi, and its derivative. And schematical equation takes the form 17. So we second order derivatives of both fields, and on the right hand side we have psi plus that function phi, and on the left hand side there are also some functions of metric and psi. In usual metric, well, in usual Plibonsky formulation, let me say, the second term on the left-hand side and second term on the right-hand side are not there. And psi becomes expressible in terms of the metric. Psi becomes wild curvature of the metric. And this is why it's not an extra field. Because on equations of motion, it becomes expressible through the metric. Here, it's also not an extra field in that sense that, in principle, at least one can solve for psi, but the equation, one has to solve it much more complicated. In particular, one has to invert derivative operators. Solving for psi, one gets very complicated expression for it, in which can be expanded in powers of metric, derivatives, and so on. One gets an infinite series. And at least in principle, one can substitute this infinite series back into the action. And so we see that quantum modified Plibonsky theory is equivalent to usual quantum modified GR with an infinite number of high derivative terms. The question then rises, what kind of derivative expansions in usual metric-based formulation can arise, can be obtained this way? Can most general derivative expansion in metric-based formulation be expressed in terms of just by adding this extra term phi into Plibonsky action? These are all interesting questions. I don't know answers to them. But it's clear, and this is my next slide, slide 22, is that the two expansions are different. Because if in Plibonsky formulation one adds simplest possible modification, namely trace psi squared, even that simple modification already gives an infinite expansion when interpreted in metric terms, because even in this simpler case, one will have to invert certain derivative operator. So the expansions are quite different. And this is probably a way to understand why it is possible that in this Plibonsky formulation, the quantum modified theory, one gets a second order. This is clearly not possible with any finite number of R of G terms in metric-based formulation. Any finite number of them clearly introduces high derivatives. However, what happens here is that certain resummation of this series does not introduce high derivatives. So this is this makes this Plibonsky formulation quite powerful. Okay, next slide, slide 23. Here's a just brief remark about the Hamiltonian formulation of this theory, namely quantum modified theory. This is something that was worked out recently by Ingemar Bengtsson, and I know it from him privately. The Hamiltonian constraints in this theory takes the form of a certain homogeneous function of degree 1 as a function of quantities, which I denoted here by EEE, EEF, EFF, basically all possible invariants constructed from the canonical variable E that we have and the curvature of spin connection A. And just for comparison, in usual GR case in Ashtekar, in Ashtekar formulation, the Hamiltonian constraint is EEF. So here it takes more complicated form, all possible invariants constructed from E and F appear, but the form is still, well, I thought it is in equation 18. It's still relatively simple. It's still a homogeneous function of order 1. Yes?
There is a question from Penn State. Hi. When you were talking earlier about the Plebansky action, was it Euclidean gravity or Lorentzian gravity?
It's Lorentzian. It's Lorentzian gravity.
And on this slide, when you say the constraint is EEF, that is actually Euclidean gravity. So I was just a bit confused.
No, it's Lorentzian. There is this Ashtekar formulation. There is an I. The connection A becomes complex in this case. And, well, that was...
So in the Plebansky action you talked about, various fields are complex, is that?
Yes, all the fields in Plebansky action are complex values.
And when you did, so presumably they satisfy some reality conditions, and are those kind of preserved when you make these field redefinitions?
They don't have, well, you can think of it as to this complex value action, you just have to add the complex conjugate action with all the fields complex conjugate in it. And on that complex conjugate action, the renormalization acts in the same way. So, yes, it seems to me that the structure of the full theory, namely containing self-dual part, anti-self-dual part, is similar.
Thanks.
So it was just a brief note about the Hamiltonian constraints. Any questions about that? Okay, let me continue then. Slide number 24. So I will illustrate how this theory works now on a simple example of a spherically symmetric solution. And this is work done together with Yuri Shtanov, who is now visiting PI. So the idea is that one starts with a spherically symmetric ANSATZ for this two-form field BA, and one just takes most general spherically symmetric two-form with values in the Lie algebra. One finds that spherical symmetry implies that the Lagrange multiplier field psi is a diagonal one, namely, well, because it's traceless, it has to be 1, 1, minus 2. And that is exactly like in GR case. In GR, because this is wild curvature, one calls, well, this property, the diagonal property of the wild curvature implies that space-time is algebraically special. So in a certain sense, it is algebraically special here because this Lagrange multiplier field has the same properties. Or in spinner notations, this field psi is written like in equation 19, we have a certain function beta, which is a function of radius, of radial coordinate and time in general. And then we have, well, certain rank 4 symmetric spinner constructed from the basic spinners, iota and omicron. And then the function phi that is part of the action just becomes function of this field beta. So beta is part of the wild curve of this Lagrange multiplier field, the only non-trivial component of the Lagrange multiplier field that remains in spherical symmetry. On slide 25, I describe what a metricity equation means in this modified context. it turns out that B has relatively simple form. This form is very similar to the usual metric situation. In the metric situation, B can be expanded into rank 2 spinners, iota, iota, omicron, omicron, and symmetrized iota, omicron. The coefficients, two forms that appear in this expansion are, they're usually called self-dual. Well, I'll explain which terms they're self-dual. ML, NM bar, and LN minus MM bar. Maybe I should say that I'm using here doubly null tetrad, which is very convenient for all these games. So it's kind of Penrose formulation, Penrose techniques for GR. They're very convenient for analyzing this theory. So the only modification that appears due to non-metricity is that there is a new function C appearing in front of the first two terms. In metric situation, C would be equal to 1, and B would be the same expression, just with C equal to 1. So we got an extra function sitting in the expression for B. This tetrad, null tetrad, is given by equations 21. They're exactly the usual null tetrad in spherical symmetry. And given a null tetrad, well, given a tetrad, one has a metric, because one can simply define a metric by requiring that the tetrad is orthonormal in this metric. So once B gives rise to any tetrad, we have a metric, and this is how metric appears. And there is an extra equation that follows from metricity equations, and it relates C squared, well, that function C, to the derivative of function phi. That function phi, if you remember, it's the function that appears in the action. So this is equation 22. Now, next slide, slide 26. The metric, as I said, can be introduced once one has a tetrad, and it has the usual spherical symmetric form. Usual GR corresponds to phi equal to 0 or C equal to 1. And here is a simple explanation of why metric is only defined up to conformal factor. Can we go on the previous slide, slide 25? It's a matter of choice now where this modification appears, because it can be introduced in front of the last term in equation 20. And this is equivalent to conformal rescaling of the metric. So this makes it clear why, at least in this context, metric is only defined up to a conformal factor. But this is a general situation. So slide 26 again. And the above choice, the one given on the previous slide, is geometrically preferred because with this choice of conformal factor, the area of spheres of symmetry computed using metric coincides with area computed using B. The point is that B, Lie algebraically two form, can be used to compute areas of surfaces. One doesn't need metric to compute areas. B is enough. And so areas agree with this choice of conformal factor. This is why it's more geometrically preferred. And actually, it turns out that equations simplify with this choice of conformal factor and with this choice of radial coordinate. So, equation, slide 27, please. Compatibility equations relate B in terms of a tetrad and connection. Like in usual GR, one can solve for the connection, express it in terms of derivative of the metric. And this is the solution. Here I introduce some notation. A minus, A plus, and A are one forms that appear as coefficients in the expansion of A into symmetric rank 2 spinners. And this A's one form are given by equations 24. I'm just reminding, M bar, LN are one forms, tetrads. And this function G star and F star are C, where C is that function that is responsible for modification, multiplying the metric functions, G and F. Then, as in GR, spherical symmetry implies staticity. So, there is no time derivatives involved. And now on slide 28, Einstein equations can be obtained from the equation. When one gets bivariant with respect to B, the equation one gets is F plus something multiplying B is equal to zero. So these equations imply one of them just is algebraic equation, and it gives expression for G star in terms of beta. Beta is a component of the curvature, and in this non-metric situation, field, extra field phi appears. If phi is equal to zero, then that's the usual Schwarzschild solution. We'll see why that is so. And then F star G star is exponent of a certain integral involving field phi, well, derivative of field phi with respect to beta. So this derivative is a function of beta itself. So if we know beta, we know the solution because it's given by equation 26. There are two more equations which are equivalent to Bianchi identity. Bianchi identity is something is a differential equation satisfied by the curvature. And so Bianchi identity takes a very simple form here. It's given by equation 27. You see that in the non-metric situation, when phi is equal to zero, this term in the brackets on the left-hand side is not there, and we just have B prime, where prime is derivative with respect to radius. B prime over B is minus 3 over R. If we integrate that, we get that B is 1 over R cubed. And this is what we know about, well, this is how wild curvature behaves in Schwarzschild solution. However, with phi, this equation gets modified, and modification is explained on the next slide, 28. Here, to analyze what this modification does, I choose the simplest possibility. I choose phi to be given by beta squared. If you remember, phi is a function of trace psi squared psi cube. So to the lowest leading order, it's basically psi, trace of psi squared, which is beta squared. And to give it correct dimensions, we have to introduce a length scale, L, in front of it, because beta has dimension 1 over length squared, and phi must have the same dimension. So this is why L squared is present there. And one should think of it as Planck scale, because this is a scale where quantum corrections become important. However, it doesn't have to be exactly G Newton. It may be some multiple of it, but it's of the order of Planck scale. So Bianchi identity becomes this equation 28, and its solution is given by 29. However, you see, it becomes a transcendental equation on beta, on the wild curvature, or on this Lagrange multiplier field. And I chose the integration constant on the right-hand side to agree with Schwarzschild solution with L is equal to zero when we don't have a modification. It's a transcendental equation. To solve it, well, we cannot really solve it for beta, but we can analyze what the solution is in various limits. And on slide 30, can I have the slide? So for large R, it's very easy to see that beta becomes the usual thing, what it is in Schwarzschild spacetime, plus a correction. The correction behaves as 1 over R to the 6. And what it means for metric functions, it means that we have corrections to the metric functions of the order of L squared R plus over R cubed. So it's clear that these are absolutely tiny corrections. If L is of the order of L Planck, these are absolutely tiny corrections, completely unobservable by experiments in solar systems. So, well, this is what we expect from quantum corrections. On slide 31, I start to analyze what happens inside the black hole. Because as we decrease the radius, this wild curvature field beta, which behaves as 1 over R cubed, starts to increase. And at some point, these corrections become important. And it's clear just by, well, by quick look at that equation, beta exponent minus L squared beta is equal to something, shows that there is a maximum value of beta, there is maximum value of beta that can be reached. It's clear that, well, maybe I should phrase it differently. It's clear that a real solution for beta exists from that equation only when R is greater, when R is greater than certain R critical, where R critical is given by equation 32. Near this critical radius, the metric itself becomes singular. And, well, this critical radius is clearly inside the black hole for large enough black holes. Maybe I should also say that the fact that there is a horizon is unmodified because curvatures on the horizon itself are not large enough to cause any significant modifications. But, of course, inside the black hole, curvatures are large. And so inside the black hole itself, at this critical radius, the metric becomes singular, but the fields of the fields in which the theory is formulated are not. The B field and the field psi are not singular. And actually one can analyze, because equations are written in terms of the fields, not in terms of the metric, one can, nothing happens at this critical radius. One can simply continue through this critical radius, and so the theory itself is non-singular inside the black hole. What happens, one can continue, as I said, beyond the critical radius, but as a preliminary work shows, one simply starts, this continuation simply starts to increase the radius of the spheres of symmetry. So it looks like when one goes inside the black hole and reaches this critical radius, the sphere of the minimal size, but then the sphere starts to expand again and another universe opens up. So the black hole starts to look like a wormhole. That's what it seems that theory does. Can I have slide 32? There is another thing that happens because of these modifications. Horizon only exists if R plus is large enough. It turns out that when black hole, would-be black hole is too small, when the mass is too small, when R plus becomes, when R plus is equal to 2L over E, where E is just exponent to power 1, this horizon coincides with this minimal sphere that is possible, and there are no smaller objects in this theory. There are no smaller black holes. Other slide, slide 33. So here's my summary, what I talked about. Our first slide is about quantum theory, summary of quantum theory. We saw that in this Lebesgue formulation, expansion in powers of curvature becomes expansion in powers of Lagrange multiplier field. There is a very non-trivial relation between these two expansions. The quantum character theory is second-order derivatives, something not possible with only a finite number of curvature terms. The beta function is some functional of this function phi lambda 1, lambda 2. Its computation is within reach. And one can, quite possibly one can answer, one can see whether the asymptotic safety conjecture of Weinberg is correct, namely whether there is a non-trivial limit of when one sends energy to infinity, this function phi goes to something finite. And the other slide, slide 34, is my summary of quantum geometry. Space-time singularity inside a black hole is avoided. The metric itself with one choice of conformal factor is singular, but metric is not the fundamental variable anymore. B the two form is, and the fundamental variable is non-singular. One can continue through the singularity, well, just because there is no singularity anymore. Largest curvature switched are of the order 1 over L squared, and this one can view the effect of this term, the modifying term, as some cosmological constant that when curvatures become large, it starts acting and prevents geodesics from forming the singularity. And the smallest black hole size is order L Planck. Okay, this is it. Questions, please.
So I have one question. So in your model, the parameter L, is there any way to determine it theoretically, or one just has to postulate that it's of the order of L Planck?
No, it's very clear that it's of the order of L Planck just by... I remember I was talking about rescaling of folded fields. So in quantum theory, one works with fields with their canonical dimensions, and L Planck never appears. But after, for example, after this fixed point of renormalization group flow, phi star, is determined, one should probably work at that fixed point, because at that fixed point, theory becomes finite. There are no divergences, because beta function vanishes and there are no divergences in this theory. So we have some dimensionless function phi star of dimensionless quantities. But then to bring this action into its usual GR form, to reintroduce usual dimensions of all the fields, one simply has to rescale the fields back, and one uses G to do that. G, as we know it, the one that sits in front of Einstein-Hilbert action. So it's pretty clear that L is basically L Planck, just because G Newton has to reappear in front of the action. But precise relation.
It's phenomenological, basically. But is it exactly equal to L Planck, or it can be 10 times L Planck, or 0.1 times L Planck?
Yeah, it's some number of order 1, because only numbers of order 1 can appear in... If you work with dimensionless quantities, which are numbers, only numbers of order 1 can appear. So it's some number of order 1 times. Yeah. But to answer that precisely, one would have to understand this phi star, the fixed point, whether it exists, first of all, whether this asymptotic safety conjecture is true, and to understand what this function is. Only after that is understood, one can say something more meaningful about the exact relation. But it's of the order of L Planck.
So you mentioned that this new term, which is introduced in the action, it behaves effectively like a positive cosmological constant and causes negative pressure. So
it can also behave like a negative cosmological constant. It depends on the sign in front of that term.
But if it acts like a negative cosmological constant, how will it give you any repulsion to avoid singularity?
It will probably give you contraction. It will give you geodesic wall, because it acts as a attractive force for geodesic.
So then the singularity will not be avoided. So you need
will
it.
Not be avoided. Yeah. One needs a certain.
So
sign.
You need a positive cosmological.
You need a certain sign in front of that term. Yeah.
So can you write, or have you checked whether you, any effective stress energy tensor which you can write behaves is conserved? That it obeys any conservation law?
Oh, yes. That was done. And in this theory, there is analog of contracted Bianchi identity. And it turns out this contracted Bianchi identity simply says that whatever you write down on the right-hand side of this modified Einstein equations, some stress energy tensor, it first appears as a two-form with values in the Lie algebra. But then using B, you can make it into a symmetric tensor of rank 2. And it turns out that symmetric tensor should simply be conserved with the metric determined by B. So the conservation equation is unmodified. It's the usual metric. It's the usual conservation equation as we used to it in GR. So this theory manages to preserve even the conservation equation in the usual form.
So there is one more question from Ben, sir.
I mean, in the black hole solution, you only considered phi up to beta squared term, right?
Yeah, that was done just to simplify the analysis.
But at the point when things become interesting, like for example, for large curvature, you would expect probably all the infinite terms to be present, right?
This is why the details of this solution near, inside the black hole, near the would-be singularity, the detailed solution should not be trusted because phi should not be trusted itself. But
you
the behavior of the solution, qualitative behavior, should be trusted.
Okay.
Because one can, near that point of the turn, where near critical radius, one can approximate the function by the parabola.
Okay.
So, and this is why it's a pretty good approximation near that point.
Okay, so you're saying...
One can say that for any function, for any reasonable function, phi, the fact that b and psi are non-singular, this is preserved. One can show that in full generality.
Okay.
Any other questions?
So if there are no more questions, let us thank Kirill.